From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the United Nations makes its strongest call yet for the violence and bloodshed to end in Gaza.
It is time for an immediate, unconditional humanitarian ceasefire. In the name of humanity, the violence must stop.
Also today, a court at The Hague gives Russia a $50 billion headache. And we hear from our Africa correspondent as two US health workers are taken ill with the deadly Ebola virus.
Two US medical workers and doctors who have become infected with the Ebola virus in Liberia are still very critical, very serious. And the health authorities have stated that the mortality rate of Ebola at this moment at world standards is about 60%.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The United Nations Security Council has called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Rocket attacks appeared to lessen overnight, but no formal truce has been agreed to. Nick Harper reports from the UN headquarters in New York.
At the emergency meeting that took place just after midnight into Monday morning, the Security Council said an immediate and unconditional humanitarian ceasefire was needed. It was a unanimous call for a durable truce that would allow for humanitarian access and time to negotiate a longer-term peace. However, there's disappointment this was a presidential statement rather than a stronger, more formal resolution. The Palestinian representative at the UN, Riyad Mansour, expressed concern that the statement didn't go far enough, while Israel's ambassador, Ron Prosser, accused the Security Council of anti-Israel bias, as the statement did not mention Hamas by name.
The United Nations also says the downing of Malaysian jet MH17 over Ukraine may amount to a war crime. This follows the latest report from the UN stating that at least 1,129 people have died in the conflict. William Denslow has the latest.
According to Ukrainian officials on Monday, MH17's data recorders indicate a rocket caused massive explosive decompression that brought down the plane. Both Ukrainian authorities and pro-Russian separatists blame each other for the crash that killed all 298 people on board. Stating that these actions may amount to war crimes, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, says anyone committing serious violations of international law will be brought to justice.
The economy of the EU could be harmed by up to 40 billion euro this year as part of sectoral economic sanctions against Russia, according to the European Commission. Diplomats from across the 28 EU member states are working through the legal documents for sanctions before approving the measures, expected to happen on Tuesday. Here's Europe correspondent Jack Perrock.
Predictions are the EU's GDP will take a 0.3% hit by implementing the capital markets restrictions and trade bans on defence and high-tech goods. Italy, for instance, which has a struggling economy, is concerned these restrictions will place them back into recession. But German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier said Russia had given the EU no other option by supporting the pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine. The Russian economy is expected to lose 23 billion euro this year through the sanctions. That's 1.5% of its GDP. The International Monetary Fund was already predicting a slowdown in Russian growth. The EU hopes these measures will force President Putin to cooperate over the Ukraine crisis by threatening his weakened economy. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Russia has been ordered to pay $50 billion to shareholders of the defunct oil company Yukos by the Court of Arbitration in The Hague. The firm was once the biggest oil producer in Russia and was found to have been unlawfully forced into bankruptcy by President Putin's government. Though Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the state intends to appeal the verdict, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the former owner of Yukos, says he welcomes the court's decision. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
Mikhail Khodorkovsky described his satisfaction with the court's ruling, but expressed regret that the money would be paid from the Russian budget rather than by individuals from the state-linked mafia that took over his company in 2003. Mr. Khodorkovsky served a 9-year prison term on charges of tax evasion and embezzlement before being pardoned by Russian President Vladimir Putin in December last year. He subsequently sought asylum in Switzerland and announced he was stepping down from politics. Russia has 10 days to appeal the ruling of the Dutch arbitration panel. Daria Bondarchuk, Moscow.
And the UK is set to send more than 1,300 troops to Poland for a major exercise to support allies in Eastern Europe. Exercise Black Eagle will take place in October amid continuing tensions over Ukraine. Here's Dan Whitehead from London.
The full battle group being sent by the UK is the biggest commitment by the country to the region since 2008. The Ministry of Defence says the UK has already sent RAF Typhoon jets to support NATO in the area following Russia's annexation of Crimea. The British Defence Secretary Michael Fallon said the deployment will demonstrate the UK's commitment to the collective security of Britain's allies in Eastern Europe. The move comes ahead of the NATO summit in Wales in September. Dan Whitehead, London.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The United Nations has made a further push for peace after 3 weeks of fighting between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas. The Security Council has called for an immediate and unconditional ceasefire, while the Secretary General has said Gaza is in a critical condition. Nick Harper reports from the UN in New York.
In his most direct language to date, Ban Ki-moon pleaded for an end to the violence that has gripped Gaza for the last 3 weeks.
It is time for an immediate, unconditional humanitarian ceasefire. In the name of humanity, the violence must stop.
The Secretary General has just returned from an 8-country, 6-day tour of the Middle East to try and broker a peace deal along with the US Secretary of State John Kerry. Those attempts fell through, and despite numerous partial ceasefires over the last few days, no formal truce has been agreed. Ban said the Israeli and Palestinian leaders had it in their power to stop the bloodshed, and he appealed not to their political minds, but to their human hearts.
They have to show humanity as leaders, both Israeli and Palestinians. When they continue to fight, then it's only the people, only the civilians, helpless civilians, who are being suffered and killed.
A few hours before, the UN Security Council met in New York at a hastily arranged midnight emergency session. The Council's current president, Eugene Gasana of Rwanda, read out their statement.
The Security Council expresses strong support for the call by international partners and the Secretary General of the United Nations for an immediate and unconditional humanitarian ceasefire, allowing for delivery of urgently needed assistance.
It was a unanimous call for a durable truce that would allow for humanitarian access and time to negotiate a longer-term peace. It's the strongest call yet from the UN Security Council for an end to the violence. But this presidential statement falls short of what some were hoping for, a more formal and weightier resolution. Palestinian representative at the UN, Riyad Mansour, expressed his disappointment that the statement didn't go far enough, but his hope that Israel would cease hostilities.
So we will see whether Israel will honor and respect this humanitarian ceasefire and whether they will continue with this aggression against our people.
Israel's ambassador, Ron Prosser, accused the Security Council of anti-Israel bias, as the statement did not mention Hamas by name. And he condemned the Palestinian militant group for failing to honour previous ceasefires.
Israel agreed to 5 ceasefire proposals. Hamas rejected or broke all of them, even the ones that they requested by themselves. Every single time the international community called for a ceasefire, we seized and Hamas fired.
The Secretary General said on Monday Gaza was in a critical condition. The UN estimates more than 1,000 Palestinians, mostly civilians, have been killed. And it says about 10% of the Palestinian population is now sheltering at UN facilities, like the school in Beit Hanun that was hit by shelling on Friday, killing 16 civilians and injuring hundreds of others. As the world celebrates the end of Ramadan, Ban Ki-moon hopes both sides will call a ceasefire, work at peace, and stop acting, as he put it, in a morally wrong way. Nick Harper, New York.
This is FSN Reports. Two American healthcare workers are being treated in West Africa after testing positive for Ebola. Dr. Kent Brantley was working in Liberia tackling the deadly outbreak when he recognised his own symptoms and placed himself in isolation. Nancy Wrightbowl of North Carolina also tested positive for the virus. Some 660 people have died in the affected areas of Liberia, Sierra Leone and Guinea. Gary Alfonso is our Africa correspondent.
Well, the condition of the two U.S. Medical workers and doctors who have become infected with the Ebola virus in Liberia is still very critical, very serious, and the health authorities have stated that the mortality rate of Ebola at this moment at world standards is about 60%, no longer 90%. So some progress is being made in treating the disease, but those health workers still very sick, and many others could still be infected in the coming weeks.
Nigeria has also been affected. That's where you are, Gary. What's the latest you can tell us about that?
Well, I can tell you that the death of a man that subsequently been identified as having had the Ebola virus at the Lagos International Airport has really sent the health authorities scurrying throughout this city of 20 million people, that's Lagos in Nigeria, where there's now major concern and very, very serious concern from health authorities that should this disease be able to spread in a city like Lagos and then also other southern cities like Port Harcourt in Nigeria, there's a very real chance that in an environment like this, the disease could get a real foothold. And the World Health Organization has warned that this is the most serious outbreak of the disease in the past 40 years since the first cases were identified in 1976. So very real concern, and all sorts of precautions at the airport and airlines are taking very specific in very specific circumstances, trying to curtail the free movement of passengers that might be coming from West African cities. And some regional airlines have actually closed certain flights from West Africa, and particularly from Liberia, Sierra Leone and Guinea, where the other outbreaks have been, and up to 700 people have died so far. So it's much more a containment issue than it is trying to prevent the disease at this point. But as the World Health Organization has stated, this is a very contagious disease, and it can spread very quickly, particularly because in countries and in cultures where physical touch and very often with open coffins and at funerals and when there's physical touch involved with sick people, like in African cultures, there's a very real chance it could spread very quickly. So at the airport, precaution, and very visibly at this stage, and it's probably the first time ever I've seen something of this extent at the airports in Nigeria.
The reports, I certainly saw a report in the New York Times today that health workers in that affected area of West Africa are also coming under some suspicion from locals, who accusing them of even being behind the spread of the Ebola virus.
Yeah, there's certainly some suspicion from local communities, not only in West Africa, but generally where Ebola has broken out, that there's, you know, perhaps because of the Western medical care that's provided and the isolation of patients, that in perhaps in some way there might be some indication that this Western medicine is viewed with a lot of suspicion, and the way in which it is it deals with patients that suffer from the Ebola virus. But I think one can also generally see from West Africa, where up to 700 people have died of the disease so far, that that obviously it's very contagious, and mostly transmits from one patient to another through body's saliva or body liquids. So it's not an airborne disease, and it also it lives in areas that's very swampy and in the forested areas of particularly Central Africa and in the Central African Republic and the Congo, where it originated in 1976. So it's it could be a very contagious disease, and the World Health Organization and Nigerian health authorities are very concerned that this kind of disease could spread very quickly in the kind of warm and swampy environments of southern Nigeria, which is very similar to that of Sierra Leone and Liberia.
Gary Alfonso in Nigeria. $50 billion, the eye-watering sum that a court at The Hague ruled Russia should pay to former shareholders of the now-defunct Russian oil company Yukos. The court said Russian officials had forced Yukos into bankruptcy and put its boss, Kremlin opponent Mikhail Khodorkovsky, behind bars. The landmark decision puts even more strain on Vladimir Putin as international pressure over Russia's role in the Ukraine crisis and the downed Malaysian passenger jet persist. Russia's finance ministry said it will appeal the Dutch court ruling. Tom Barton is in Moscow.
The largest compensation package ordered ever by this court in The Hague, and that is to do with the oil company Yukos. It used to be Russia's largest oil company, it used to be headed by Russia's richest man, but it was all torn down. And today in this court, the judges ruled that $50 billion should be the damages payable for what they say was not proper legal process in the shutting down, the bankruptcy of Yukos. It was essentially a politically motivated decision. 10 years in the making, say those who have been fighting for what they say is this great victory for them. And one key quote that's come out of it really is this from the ruling: Russian courts bent to the will of Russian executive authorities to bankrupt Yukos, assign its assets to the state-controlled company, and incarcerate a man who gave signs of becoming a political competitor.
Obviously referring there to Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Tom, can you explain then what has the Russian reaction to this been? Because this comes at a time when Moscow is under a lot of strain, especially when you think about the Ukrainian crisis and that most recent development concerning flight MH17.
Yes, certainly not a time that the Russians would want any more negative publicity, but here it is. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov gave a press briefing at which he said that as far as he was concerned, Russia would try to use all the legal possibilities that it still had open to it to defend its position, and that it would appeal against this decision.
Я слышал сегодня утром сообщение о том, что подобный вердикт ожидается.
I heard this morning reports that such a verdict is expected. I think it's important to wait for this to happen, and then we can make comments. You've mentioned the fact that the court procedures are not over. Appeal is possible. The Russian side, those agencies which represent Russia in the process, will no doubt use all available legal possibilities to defend its position.
And Tom, what have you heard from people who better understand the ins and outs of a complicated case like this involving so much money? What do they think the chances are of Russia actually stumping up the cash?
It seems that there's very little chance that that they will pay that money up. A, it means that they would have to admit their guilt. And B, it's a hell of a lot of money. $50 billion is well publicised for another Russian price tag, and that is the price of the Sochi Olympics, infamous for the level of corruption and wasted money in that project, and a huge blow to a Russian economy that is already on the verge of recession anyway and facing possible further sanctions. So really not another bill that President Vladimir Putin wants to land on his doormat. But having said that, the Russian government doesn't have total freedom in its choice of not paying this. There is the possibility that those who have been campaigning for this decision, that have been in court against the Russian government, can now, through the rules of the Hague Court, go and try and seize assets to try and get their money back. And some of them have already said that they're ready to move on to that stage now and start, as they say it, hunting the globe to try and find Russian assets abroad to seize, to try and get their money back.
Tom Barton in Moscow. This is FSN Reports. Now, they may be produced in small regional breweries, but American craft beers are increasingly becoming big business. With $14.3 billion in sales in 2013, American brewers are increasingly setting their sights on foreign markets, and with some success. Mary McCarthy reports from Colorado, which last year tripled its foreign exports of craft beer.
A refreshing after-work beer on a hot day at one of Denver's many craft breweries.
We have 25 taps. All of them are different beers. These change out quite often. We sometimes get small batches in or seasonal beers.
Jenny Rochow is in charge of front-of-house operations at Epic Brewery. She says that craft beer drinkers liken themselves to wine connoisseurs, analyzing and appreciating the subtlety of each brew.
This is our Imperial Stout, aged in whiskey or bourbon barrels with cocoa nibs and coffee. So it's really complex, really rich. It's a great after-dinner drink.
For now, most of Colorado's craft brews are sold domestically, but market experts say the dark ales and lagers that characterize American craft beer also appeal to the international palate. Canada, the United Kingdom, and Sweden are the biggest export destinations for now, but growth has also been substantial in the Asia-Pacific region. Mark Snyder of the Brewers Association.
There's a high demand for American craft beers in strong affluent markets like Beijing or Shanghai, for example.
Foreign sales of Colorado craft beer have been so successful that the industry has been cited as a model for the future of American exports.
The export story isn't just about big businesses, it's all about small and medium-sized businesses as well.
Ambassador Michael Froman, who oversees trade for the Obama administration, recently stopped in to sample some of the brews.
This business currently is less than 500 employees, but if they keep on growing the way they're growing, they're going to quickly exceed that as well as their space here.
In Colorado alone, an estimated 5,500 people are directly employed in the craft brewing industry. And that figure is much higher if you account for related jobs, says Steve Karowski of the Colorado Brewers Guild.
These breweries are very high maintenance. They're labor-intensive breweries. These breweries don't solve problems by technology. They solve their problems by hiring people. It's a very hands-on position and a very hands-on thing to make craft beer.
For now, craft beer makes up less than 15% of total U.S. beer sales. But while sales of traditional brews have been dropping, craft beer sales continue to rise, suggesting that the future of the U.S. beer market might very well lie in the small breweries popping up in many American cities. In Denver, I'm Mary McCarthy.
And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. Here's Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, the campaign for Scottish independence and whether it might finally achieve its goal in just a few weeks' time. If the Scottish National Party has its way, the territory is on the brink of becoming the world's newest nation state, following in the footsteps of countries like South Sudan, East Timor, and the ex-republics of the former Soviet Union. So what are the chances of Scotland leaving the rest of Britain behind and establishing its own relationships with the rest of the world? The Economist has visited Scotland and found that for many voters, it's a pocketbook question.
On September the 18th, the people of Scotland will vote in a referendum to decide whether to remain within the United Kingdom or whether to take a leap of faith and form an independent country. It's the most important decision that Scots will have made in over three centuries. But there are many unanswered questions about the prospect of an independent Scotland. It's not clear what currency the new country would use, whether it could be a member of the European Union, or the wider impact that independence would have on its economy. Scots are hesitant about going solo. Recent opinion polls suggest that 59% will vote to stay within the Union. But this has not deterred the Yes campaign. Driven largely by the Scottish National Party, it's redoubling its efforts to win over poor constituencies like this one in the East End of Glasgow, in the hope of swaying undecided voters. And while the Yes campaign is on the offensive, the Unionist Better Together campaign has been notably absent from these streets.
Sorry, it's hard to find out which way the numbers are going. They're all in shadow.
Mary McCabe is a Yes campaign activist. She's been a proponent of Scottish independence for more than 30 years.
I'm here from Yes Scotland about the referendum we're going to be having on independence. It's just really one question. If there's a scale of 1 to 10 and 1 is no to independence for Scotland, 10 is yes for independence for Scotland, which number on the scale of 1 to 10 would you place?
I'm not taking any part yet.
You're not going to vote at all?
No. Don't know enough about it, so I'm no.
Right, well, I mean, I've got leaflets and things.
I'm all right, cheers anyway.
Right, okay. What more people ask about is, are we too poor? They still have this thing in their heads, what we call the WPS syndrome, too wee, too poor, too stupid, which we say down the decades we've been told that we are too wee, too poor, and too stupid to run our own affairs. So people do ask, do we have the money? Is it all about oil? Because it's been presented as if it's all about oil. This badge is over 30 years old. It's a badge I wore at the 1979 devolution referendum. And I wear it to remind myself that the same people told the same lies and threats then.
Shettleston, a district in the east end of Glasgow, is one of Britain's poorest areas. Male life expectancy here is 63. That's 14 years lower than the UK national average and one of the worst levels in the European Union.
Places like the east end of Glasgow, you know, they're the kind of places where the message that we're somehow better together doesn't really resonate. You've only got to go a kind of stone's throw from here and you'll find kind of massive levels of poverty and inequality. The reality is that we live in Scotland, a country that has 59 MPs. Only one of those MPs is a Conservative, yet we've got a Conservative Prime Minister. How does that work?
At core is the issue of whether people would be better off economically in or out of the Union. In one poll, over half of respondents said that they would vote for either side if it made them richer by £500 a year. The SNP claims that each Scot would be £1,000 richer in an independent Scotland. But on the other hand, the Unionist Better Together campaign says that Scots will be £1,400 better off if they stick with Britain. Those kinds of figures hold a lot of sway with voters here.
What would be your main concern?
My own money in my pocket, as I said. That's my main concern, to keep me going, because I'm a widow and I stay myself, so more money and I would maybe get on a wee bit better. You understand, you know?
Voting. Well, I think I'm going to vote no.
You're going to vote no, that's fine. Is there anything particular putting you off voting yes in the referendum? Or?
Well, if things fell flat in their face, where would we end up?
You'll be voting yes, that's fine. And is everybody else in the household of the kind of same opinion? Or?
Aye.
The separatist fiscal promises are based on an expectation that an independent Scotland would earn revenues from North Sea oil of around £7 billion a year by 2018. The Independent Office for Budget Responsibility thinks otherwise. It says that revenue from oil taxes will be less than half of that for this period. Currently, Scots receive 15% more per head in public funding than the rest of Britain. The Yes campaign offers a dream of a richer, independent Scotland. However, its rosy projections about oil revenue cannot be relied upon. Add to this Scotland's ageing population and a national party intent on overspending, it seems, and the economic reality of an independent Scotland becomes progressively bleaker. But the Yes campaigners soldier on. They're buoyed with great hope that they can win this referendum and take Scotland solo.
Right, one, two, smile.
Yay!
Right.
That doesn't look probable, but it's not impossible.
There's more on the battle over Scotland's future in the latest edition of The Economist, both in print and online at economist.com. And FSN is planning extensive coverage of the Scottish referendum in September. You'll hear that on this very programme, FSN Reports. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. Remember, if you'd like to get in touch, you can email us, reports@featurestory.com, and follow us on Twitter, @FeatureStory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.